Hello, everyone. It's February 27th, 2023, and we're continuing. This is class number four of Letters of the Rav. I want to get right to it because a lot to do. Many people have emailed me, not about the Rav's letters, although we got some great stuff about that I'll share with you, but about the whole kashrus thing. And wait till you see what I've come up with here, and I'm gonna give you some insights, I think, tonight. But before we get to that, we will not be meeting next Monday night because of Purim. So Larry writes to me that he remembers what I said about Megillah, about Ritzfat, but he forgot the other point about Hodu. So you know what? We have all these new people, so I'll quickly repeat it again. And then for those who've been with me, I'll tell you something I don't think I've ever said, so you could pay attention to it when you're in Megillah. So quickly, this is what Larry is referring to. When you're in Shul next week, this is a mistake that most of the Baalei Kriya make among the Ashkenazim. Among the Sephardim, I've never heard anyone make the mistake, but among Ashkenazim all the time. In verse 6, they read this word, Ritzfat, they read it Ritzpat. Now, really, if you want to be really medaktik, this is actually, according to the Masorah, this is a Shva Na. As you see, the Sadi there has the two larger dots in the Shva. That's how it distinguishes. This should be read Ritzafat. And the reason why Ritzpat, B'diavad, if you say it, the poskim say your Yotze, but it's definitely a mistake because the word in Biblical Hebrew, Ritzpah, you see it in Yeshayahu here, chapter 6, verse 6. Ritzpah means like a glowing coals or stones. In Biblical Hebrew, Ritzpah does not mean floor. Floor is Ritzafah. So you have to read it as Ritzafah. Now, what Larry asked me about is something else. He wanted to know why what I said, this word, mehodu, has a dagesh in the dalet. Unless you're Rabbi Jeremy Weider, I don't know anyone who stresses the dalet, but if you do, you want to stress it. And as I explained, that's because the word hodu, and we even have examples of this in the Targumim where they refer to like, it's really the nun has been dropped. India, from the Indus River. So it's really like Hundu or Hundu, other places have it. So since the nun has been dropped, then it's that's why there's a dagesh. So many of you have already heard that. So let me share a thing or two that you haven't heard, as long as we're on the topic quickly. And that is, first of all, I don't know if I said this, but you'll hear in some of your shuls in chapter 3, verse 4, when they get to, they'll say Vayehi, and then they'll say Ke'amram, Be'amram, or Be'amram, Ke'amram. I don't know what they say. Whatever they say, it's wrong, though. This is not a suffix. Later in the book, there's three, there's two psukim, Bifneham, Lifneham, and Laharog, and Vilaharog. Those are really not sfeikot. It's, in other words, if you look at all the classical sources, they're not a suffix. But in recent years, generations, I should say, they became a suffix. Okay, but this is not a suffix according to anyone. This is a kriyachtiv. A kriyachtiv, you always read the ktiv, or kri, you never read the ktiv. So here, without question, the only thing you should be reading is Ke'amram. If any of you listening are Baalei Kri, I'm sorry if you were taught to read Be'amram, Ke'amram. It's absolutely mistaken. You only read the Kri. Now, what I don't know if I mentioned that, but one thing I definitely didn't mention is about the word Shushan. Tosfos actually deals with it right at the beginning. The very first stuff in Kiddushin, in this Tosfos asks an interesting question. There he explains, why does the word Italia, you say in Italian or something, you say Italki. Even in modern Hebrew, I think we say Italki. You don't... It's Germani, Amerikai, Tsarfati. Why? Where does the kuf come from? So Rabbeinu Tam says that that's part of the word which has been dropped. And he says, similarly, Shushan, he calls attention to Ezra chapter 4, verse 9, he says that this word here, the Shushanites, Shushan Chaya, that's really the Chaf is also part of the word Shushan. Now, I have to say, I don't know if he's right about either of these things, and I would love to know where the Kuf comes from, because if you look at Italian, it definitely doesn't come from, the word Italy is not a Hebrew word. So I don't know where it comes from, but I just thought I'd share that. In terms of the pictures we saw, I want to call everyone's attention to this book. Richard Cohen's book, Jewish Icons. See it here. Art and Society in Modern Europe. He has a whole chapter on pictures of rabbis. And I thank those of you who sent me pictures of rabbis. The problem with the pictures of the rabbis is you don't know if it's actually posed or not. So, but here, some of them are definitely posed, or David Nieto and a bunch of others. In terms of the Greenberg dispute, Lichtenstein dispute, which we spoke about, I can send anyone who's interested this article, The Road Not Taken and The One Less Traveled, The Greenberg-Lichtenstein Exchange and Contemporary Orthodoxy. Adam Furziger has a lengthy article dealing with this, and there was a Jubilee volume in honor of Rabbi Yitz Greenberg. I have an article in it also, and so I could send that to you. Last class, if you recall, in the letters, we saw Rabbi Soloveitchik's strong letter saying that we can't give answers to everything. Any rabbi who says they have all the answers, well, that just shows their ignorance. Thank you, Mendy, for calling my attention. The Rav there is speaking halachically, but the Rav has an article, Sacred and Profane, and he adopts the same approach when it comes to the matter of theodicy. Why bad things happen to good people. He says, when a minister, rabbi, or priest attempts to solve the ancient question of Job's suffering through a sermon or lecture, he does not promote religious ends, but on the contrary, does them a disservice. The beauty of religion with its grandiose vistas reveals itself to man not in solutions, but in problems, not in harmony, but in the constant conflict of diversified forces and trends. And that's the Rav's major point, which he's repeated elsewhere as well, that there aren't answers to these questions. And that's what religion is all about. It's not about having the answers. It's about finding a way to deal with the problems. Incidentally, since I just mentioned Greenberg, Yitz Greenberg said something which I find very insightful. And I often repeat, you know, the question of theodicy. So you have Chas V'Shalom, you have a parent with a child, a 3-year-old child, or who's dying of leukemia, or what happened in Israel the last couple of days. So we have all these highfalutin answers for theodicy, that suffering builds your character, it brings you close to God, all these sorts of things. And what Yitz said, again, I'm not going to repeat, I don't share some of the other ideas of Yitz, but this one, 100%. If you would not feel comfortable sharing this idea next to a parent in the hospital room where the child is dying, then maybe it's not something you should ever share. Because at the end of the day, if it's theodicy, if it makes sense, it should make sense no matter where you are, not giving a lecture, and if it doesn't have real-world implications. I spoke last class about Rav Yochanan Wasserman, and I mentioned, you know, that the Rav quotes something that he heard from Rav Yochanan, and I think I might have said, I don't remember seeing a discussion of a relationship of theirs. Thank you, Nachum Shmaryahu, for reminding me of this. I know the book, but I forgot this. Seth Farber's book on the Rav, An American Orthodox Dreamer, on page 165. It talks about Rav Yochanan's trip to raise money to come to Boston. And Rabbi Zev Gotthold, who was a teacher at Maimonides in the early years, actually claimed that it was Rav Yochanan's idea to have this school, which Farber says is incorrect. But definitely Rav Yochanan was there, and so thank you, and had a relationship with the Rav. Thank you for that. Three more things I want to say. Thank you, Moshe. Moshe called my attention. I spoke about the story of Rav David Cohen, and he starts rebuking Rav Soloveitchik, and interrupting the shiur, being mocher, protesting because he thought that what the Rav said about the Brisker Rav reflected poorly on the Chazon Ish. The whole and my memory was perfect, except for I said that Rav David Cohen after this called Rav Huttner. It's actually Rav Huttner called Rav David Cohen. In this tape, you can go on YU Torah, Rabbi Rakefet, from September 3rd, 2001. You have Rav David Cohen on tape explaining, going through the whole story. And for the Hasidim of Soloveitchik, you won't be too happy, I think, when you hear it, but you get it right from Rav David Cohen himself. And let me stop sharing here. I showed you the picture of the Rav, this great painting. The painting of the Rav. I told you the whole story that one of our listeners shared with us. Well, we have an alternate version here. And the alternate version comes from Carl, who says that the Rav's oil painting shown in my presentation was commissioned by my grandfather, not the Rav's wife. It was presented to the Rav in 1953 by a group of friends, confirming it was most likely in honor of his 50th birthday. And this Morrison was he had the meat which the Rav gave hashkacha to. The Rav was mashkiach of my grandfather's kosher meat packing plant, Morrison and Schiff. But this is what he sent me. This is from the, I don't know if it's the Forward or the Jewish Advocate, portrait of Rav Joseph E. Soloveitchik. It was painted by Jacob Binder, Boston artist. And so maybe we can get to the bottom of this. He even painted Carl's grandfather. Here's a picture of Carl's grandfather. So it's the same sort of background. So thank you, Carl. And maybe we can get to the bottom of that. As you suggest, maybe it was the Rav's wife's idea, but the other people commissioned it. So that might be a pshara. Okay, the last thing I want to do before we begin, so many of you have emailed me, this has really touched a nerve, about the whole kashrus thing going on here. And we're wondering whether, like I said, it can never change, it can never happen, because we're all going to eat at Chabad, and the Rabbanim are going to eat at Chabad, and people a lot more right-wing than us. But there's something going on. And Eli emailed me as follows. I thank you very much, Eli, from Israel. The same thing going on in America is now going on in Israel. So I have to believe that there's something happening in the air. Now, what's the situation in Israel? Well, as Eli says, in many Haredi neighborhoods, there's a custom that people Thursday night buy homemade meals. So if you go to Mea Shearim, he said, there are locals selling cholent and kugel Thursday night. And it seems this has become a large phenomenon. And this is just last week. You have a whole article that, although this has been going on for years, the rabbis of Beit Har Elit, the Haredi rabbis, are coming out against this. And you can't buy, you need a hashkacha. Now, what does that mean, you need hashkacha? Does that mean that they're going to go into people's houses? They want to see what they're doing inside their houses? I don't see how that makes sense, how anyone, rabbis, are going to come to people's houses. And what's really interesting is if you read the comments, some people in the comments are saying, you know, makes sense, the rabbi should do that. Others are saying, and these are all Haredim, saying, makara, Beit Sedek rotze od kesef, busha, hakol ze kesef, shlita v'koach. And so you see that there's a whole dispute about this. So I did a little investigation. And I'll share, we'll go 5 more minutes than I usually go to. I found a sefer called Oel Yaakov. It's a whole sefer on kashrus. And it says as follows. He says, Be'eretz Yisrael me'azu mitamid kanu ma'achli me'udim yirei shamayim shoyam chesher. He says that in Eretz Yisrael, the tradition is we always bought from people who were religious, who didn't have a hechsher. And just they would publicize that all the ingredients have Heksher. But then it says, because of problems that have happened, like there was a famous catering issue, a caterer where there was a problem. Now we say that V'kabel b'tzibor liknot hazmin machim only from Heksher. However, he says, we see that Avreichim bring cakes and salads to sell it, and that you can rely on. And then he says, he quotes Rav Yaakov Shub, or I think it's Rav Yaakov, who heard from Rav Zil Arbach, "Kishemakirim ba'ofen ishi et ha-mocher shumuchsak b'kashrut." If you know someone personally, that they're religious, nitein l'smoch al ikar hadin, you can rely on the ikar hadin and buy from them. And also Rav Dablitsky ruled, "Demutar liknot machalim me'adam yirei shemayim af she'en lo heksher." And that's what I mentioned last week, Rav David Lichtenstein pushed back. Rav Chaim Kanievsky also said this. Now, there's a big mashgiach in Israel, very well accepted, the Rubin mashgiach, Rav Rubin. And he says as follows. He wrote an article some years ago. And he says as follows. He says that, yes, people who sell should get hashgachas. But if they don't get hashgachas, this is what he says. And this is one of the firmest hashgachas in Israel, as far as I know, the Rubin hashgacha. He says, listen to this. Oh, the reason I'm saying this is because before people now jump on the bandwagon and say, because the OU, and I say it's the OU, it's one person in the OU. I already told you that the posek of the OU eats it at the Chabad. Hakonim divrei ma'achal mimisada, obeite sech lemazon. That is, if you buy food from a restaurant, sheba'aleim yeduim kemuchsakim bekashrut, that the owners are known as muchsak bekashrus. Mechodavar, and they know, understand all about kashrus, and they know what to keep away from. Afal pi shera'oi shamocher yekabel tuudat hechsher, even though it's proper for the owner of the restaurant to have a hechsher, mikol makom im lo kibel tuudat hechsher, mutar lakone liknot mimenu af lechachila. If he doesn't get a hechsher and he's a religious person, you can buy from him even lechachila. And that's what we saw from Rav Chaim Kanievsky. So I wanted to show you in the few more minutes I have before we start with the Rav's letters, just how this worked in the Metzias years ago. I want to show you some pictures because I think you'll find this interesting. Let me get my pictures here. Okay. What's the first thing I want to show you? Okay. So here's an ad from the Hapar days, 1933. You have an ad for the hotel in Atlantic City, the New Yorker. And it's a whole ad that in this hotel, the New Yorker, they're preparing for Pesach. Everything is done according to the highest level of kashrus. Mr. Shmuel Mayer Groenberg or something. I can't really read it. He owns it. He's a meforsam for an isha reva shalem neman umuchsak b'kashrus. So here you have an ad in the Agudas Harabonim journal for a hotel. This hotel has no hashgacha. That's all the ads for the hotels that have hashgacha mention they have hashgacha. Here, it tells you he's muchsak b'kashrus, so you could eat there. We have other examples of this. This is from 1952, also in Hapardes. The Tides Hotel. Kosher l'mahadrin min mahadrin. But there's no mashgiach listed. Also, the Hotel Shenandoah, down in Lakewood. And the Goldstein's Hotel. These also, no kosher behechleit, but no hashgacha given. Now, I found in 1968, interestingly, here's the Agudas HaMashgichim. There used to be a union of Mashgichim, and they take out an ad in Hamaor, the journal, that you do not have, don't make reservations for the holidays, especially Pesach, in hotels that don't have hashgacha. And it says that hotels and restaurants and catering are not considered kosher if they don't have a hashgacha. And they go on, they say that some of these people with these hotels, they're mechalei Shabbos. But of course, that's the mashgichim. And we know that people didn't listen to the mashgichim, and you had hotels that were accepted by everyone. This is the Gartenberg Hotel, the Pioneer. But this is before they had the Pioneer, they had a bunch of other hotels as well. This is the Alden Hotel in Miami Beach, the Clarendon Hotel, and this is from 1945. So I started thinking that, well, what about the hotels in Switzerland? And lo and behold, I reached out to someone. It's got to be in the 70s now, grew up in Switzerland. So I said, what about the hotel in St. Moritz? The famous one, the one that all the Rebbeim and Rabbi Chaya Weimer used to go to. He said, today, every hotel in Switzerland has a shkacha. Otherwise, people would not go there. But I know that the St. Moritz Edelweiss family Berman years ago did not have one. Everyone, including Rabbonim and Rebbeis, relied on Mr. Berman and his mother. So that was the mitzvahs. And if they want to change it, if they want to make takanas, fine. I'm not opposing it. It could be a good takana. But don't make up the story as if that in the past, this is what people always did. It's not true. It's a takana. And if a takana is necessary, then fine. We need a takana. Maybe they are necessary. But I found an interesting article, which I had known before, but then I remembered it. In the biography of the Ponovej Rav, called Arav Mi Ponovej, on page 22, it talks about when Rav Kahaneman was at this hotel in St. Moritz. I just mention this here because he was there, but all the Rabbanim and the Chassid Rebbeis would go to that hotel. It was famous. But he had a great story there because he told the story that he saw something that he says you never would have seen this in Lithuania and never would have occurred to anyone in Lithuania. He said that one day at the hotel at a shul, obviously at a mikvah, I was at the different hotel, I think, in Grindelwald. But he says that what happens mincha time shabal l'sham af mispar nashim yehudiot me'atarei haski. That is, you had these women who came from skiing. They took a break on skiing. Why? Because they were makpid not to miss even one mincha. And the Ponovej Rav said mik amcha Yisrael. Hechma Timsa, where would you ever find this? That even women in the middle of skiing will stop so they can go daven mincha. I saw this ad to give you an example. Here's from Krakow. Oops, wrong thing here. I want to show you an ad in Krakow. Here's from a Krakow newspaper from 1912. It's called a mitzvah, but just the last page. So you have the ad. So right in the middle, you have an ad. Cold cuts, meats. It's produced, and it says here, it's under the Hechsher of Rav Moshe Babad, who's the Av Beis Din. But then if you look on the sides, on the left, this hotel and restaurant, kosher, run by Rosenthal, no mashkiach. Those who come to Krakow, Misadak Kshera, Mahadrin and Mahadrin, Bishkedat, Harav HaChassid, HaTorani, who's it run by? The Shlomo Frucht Handler. He's the son of Harav HaGadol, Rav Shmuel Isser, the Av Beis Din of his city. And he says, there you can have a good meal. No mashkiach. You rely on him. On the right side here, if you want to have a chasana, it tells you where you could have it. It's absolutely kosher. But again, no mashkiach. So that was the Metzias. And before ending, I just want to share one more thing. There's actually a tshuva. Many of you have traveled with me to Italy. Where do we eat in Italy? The only restaurant that's been there since 1996. Others have opened, but Gom Gom. Always Gom Gom. And in fact, last time I was in Italy, so now there's another restaurant there. But if you want to see the Hasidim, if you want to see the Payas, if you want to see the Litvish, everywhere, everyone has to go to Gom Gom. Would you believe it? There's a tshuva. Are you allowed to eat in Gom Gom? So this is in Bemara HaBazak, which is from Eretz Chemda, Volume 4, Number 70. So here's the question. This is going back to 1996 when Gom Gom opens. Here's the question. The Jewish community in Venice just appointed a rabbi who now is responsible for all the Jewish life in Venice. But there's another Jew in Venice who's a Shomer Torah Mitzvos. He wants to open a restaurant without getting the hechsher of the local rav. And he says that he already got a hechsher from a rav who lived far from a different city. He doesn't need another hechsher. Gom Gom has a hechsher. I don't know now if they have a hechsher. They had a hechsher from Rabbi Gorelick in Milan. But Milan is far away, and he didn't travel. Basically, Rabbi Gorelick gave the hechsher, but the real mashkiach on the spot is the owner. And by the way, he uses that money not just to support himself, the yeshiva they have there. It's mashiachist, incidentally. But okay, so the question is, since the rabbi who gives the hechsher is really not the mashkiach, because he never comes, he lives hundreds of miles away, the real mashkiach is the owner. Here's the question. Is he regarded the owner of Gam Gam? Is he no Gabadavar and therefore Asur Lismachalav? You can't eat there. And two, does the rabbi need to say, announce that no tourist can eat there because it's not under his hashkacha? So here's the answer. And I think this should say it, should leave it as it is, without anyone trying to tell us where, you know, where we should eat and not. So this is Eretz Chemda, very important Torah institution in Israel. Eid Echad Neman Bisur. Vafiu Aisurav Shalom. Someone who's religious, you can trust them even about his own products. Vafilu Binkom Hefsed Meruba. Even if it's a Hefsed Meruba, that is, if I'm a Shochet and I'm selling the meat, according to strict halacha, I'm not talking about takanas, you can rely on a religious person. We saw Rishon Santer said. V'lachein, bal misada, kol od shehu muksak bekashrut, ne'eman ha'id sha'ochel shehu magishu kasher, v'somchim alav. Therefore, an owner of a restaurant who's a muksak bekashrut, you can rely on him that the food he gives you is kosher, v'somchim alav, and we rely on him. And the te'udat hechsher that he got from this other rabbi, that can actually be a edut for us that he's muksak bekashrut, if you don't know any better. Which is what I said last week, that when Chabad says about these people that we give them authority, that's testimony to Moksav Kashras. The Ein Kan Isur Afil Mitzad Achshad Ko'od Ein Hatzibur Marani Nacharov. And then they go on, they ask the other question, well, what about, isn't this Asagas Gavul? And they do say, well, he should have got the Ashkocha from the local rabbi. But, you know, that doesn't change the fact that it's kosher, you could eat there. Now, obviously, he's a Chabadnik, so Chabadnikim don't like the local rabbi. But so here you have it, everyone. You come with me to Italy. We're still going to go to Gam Gam. We're going to go all those places. So that's the Masorah for at least for us when we travel. Okay, my friends. Went a little longer than normal, but because of all the emails and stuff about the kashrus thing, as I said, it's going on in Israel now too. I mean, I don't know. Can you buy lemonade at the stand down the street from your neighbor? I mean, I don't know where you're going to stop this. So takanot, as I said, 100%. It's a good takana. But you have to understand that it's a takana, because when you make him ikar adin, you then have to then go to the next level. Then what about Chabad? And you don't want to go there because you can't pasul all the Chabads. That just doesn't, it's not right. It's not the halacha. And I don't think the people who are talking about this all of a sudden are really thinking this through. Okay, so when we ended last class, we were in the middle of letter 8. And the next part of the letter, the first part of the letter dealt with the ship, with the two, the Zimliner Shalom and the two kitchens. The next part of the letter deals with missionaries. When, you know, think about this. Israel's established in 48. This is like a field day for the missionaries. All these Jews now in one place. And many of these Jews don't know that much about Judaism. You could send your missionaries there and you don't have to go far. There's Jews everywhere. Now the missionaries have to be a little smarter. The missionaries, if you read about them, they are pious and they spend years. They have such mesiras nefesh. They get embedded into Orthodox communities. And sometimes it's years before you find out about them. You had that whole scandal a few years ago and you had this guy who was a real makubal. And Alan Brill interviewed him on his, and when I say his real makubal, he knew Kabbalah. Let's put it that way. Don't call him makubal, but he was an expert in Kabbalah. You can see him all over the web. He knew his stuff, and he studied with, I think, Shar Shamayim. I mean, and he had a whole group under him, and they had infiltrated into the community. But they didn't used to have to do that. And so what can you do? This was in the news. I mean, there is freedom of speech and all that in Israel. But the Rav writes how we cannot have a new crusade, basically, in the land of Israel, and he's urging Gelman. He says, "I'm not a lawyer. I don't know the laws, what you can do, but we need to do what we can to stop the missionary threat." I think I don't know if it's still the case. If I'm not mistaken, and maybe David Eisen is a lawyer, he can help me on this. I think it was actually illegal. I mean, according to, against the law, to missionize. I don't know if it still is that. I know when the Mormons came, it was also a big issue because Mormons love to missionize, and they agreed not to do any missionizing when they established their place. But So it's only, the rub goes on for a number of lines here, basically saying that, you know, this needs to stop. We have to do what we can on it. And then he returns to the issue of the ship line, the ship. And he says he doesn't understand. What's the government fighting about? About a kitchen, a busser chazer, about pig? He says this must be, we need to settle this you know, quickly. Again, Mizrahi is part of the government. And here, you know, how are you going to be in the government when they're going to have, it's going to, Mizrahi's going to have responsibility. If they're a member of the government and then you have a ship run by the Israeli government and it has kosher and non-kosher, that's a real problem. I mean, like I said, though, is it more of a problem than having an airline fly on Shabbos? I don't know. And the ship was going to go on Shabbos. That is, the Lubavitch Rebbe said that you can't run a ship on Shabbos. And he wrote about this. He says that he understands the science behind it. So they'd be Machal Shabbos. Is Kashrus is worse than Shabbos? Actually, technically, Shabbos is worse than Kashrus. So I'm not sure why it's more symbolic, maybe why it's more symbolic and problematic to have the state of Israel involved in Tarfus than it is in Kashrus. I know that the Israeli embassies around the world are not kosher, unless the ambassador is kosher. Maybe the first secretary is kosher. When I was in Prague, my very first trip to Prague, at that time, the ambassador to he was close to Obama. He was like a conservadox Jew, but he would go to shul every Shabbos. I met him. He even invited me to come to an event, which I couldn't come at the embassy. But he told me that the only kosher embassy in Prague is the United States embassy. So the Israeli embassies don't have to be. So I don't know what. But at the time, for whatever reason, it became a big issue, and the Haredim were making it a big issue. So that's letter number 8. Letter number 9, and also letters 11 to 14, are really fascinating. Or at least a couple of them are. It's to Yitzhak Goldschlag, another Mizrahi leader who corresponded with the Rav. And letter 9 deals with a controversy that also made its way to America. It's called the Brother Daniel controversy. You had this Jew who converted to Catholicism. He didn't become a priest. He became what's called a friar. You have these people in Catholicism who are in the religious life, but they're not actually priests, but they look like a monk, whatever they look like. But he's born Jewish, just like the cardinal in Paris. He wanted to go to Israel, and there's a law of return. The law of return says if you're Jewish, immediate citizenship, all the goodies they give you. And he said, I'm Jewish, I'm coming to Israel, and I want to be accepted under the law of return. But how can you accept an apostate, a mishumad, not just a mishumad, but one who's involved in religious life, like just like a priest, let's say. Yeah, but he's biologically Jewish. Halachically Jewish, at least so we think. Let's see what the Rav says about this. But if you ask the man on the street, is Cardinal Lustiger, is he Jewish? They'd say 100% he's Jewish. Actually, he considered himself Jewish, almost like a Jew for Jesus. He considered himself a Jewish Catholic. But so this case went all the way to the Supreme Court, and the whole world was talking about this case of Brother Daniel. And on the court at the time, I think he's even might have been the head of the court, he wrote the decision, as I recall, was Justice Moshe Silberg. Moshe Silberg, a religious Jew from Tells, he even wrote a memoir of, Simcha Safa's Tells. I think he might have been Navardic, I forget now, but he wrote books on Jewish law, and he said that according to Jewish law, Brother Daniel is Jewish. And he would be accepted under the law of return. We know, even though you sin, you're still a sinning Jew. And if you're born Jewish, you're Jewish. We're not like in Catholicism, you're not a Catholic. You're not born Catholic. You're not a Catholic until you're baptized. Before that, you're not a Catholic. In Islam, until you, I'm told they sort of regard you as like Muslim, but when you're old, you need to, old enough, you need to make the proclamation. But we know you're Jewish just because you're born Jewish, even if you don't know you're Jewish. I have students in the University of Scranton who, they're Catholic, but their maternal grandmother is Jewish. So At least I've always said they're halachically Jewish. Even according to the Rav, I think they'd be. Soberg says, according to halacha, Brother Daniel is Jewish. However, the law of return is not, we're not in a halachic state. The law of return has to be understood according to the man on the street. In the non-halachic world, since it's a law that's not halachic, it's a law of the people, if you ask the person on the street, could a Catholic priest or a Catholic brother, is he Jewish? The answer is no. So since this is not a religious law, it's a secular law, it has to be understood in secular terms, and therefore they refused citizenship under the law of return. The Rav, although he's happy at the court's ruling that Brother Daniel was not to be recognized as a Jew under the law of return, he's actually very upset by the approach of the court, namely that according to halacha, he is Jewish, but this is a secular law, so therefore we're not going to regard him as Jewish in a secular sense. Because the Rav holds, and I'll explain in more detail now, that this idea, which we all grew up with and we all know, put no in quotes, that if you're born Jewish, you are always Jewish, and it's sort of like the Hotel California. You know, you can check in, but you can never check out. You know, once you're Jewish, that's it. The Rav held differently. The Rav held that just because you're born Jewish doesn't mean you're always Jewish, that you can lose your Judaism. And during this, so let me explain this. It might appear shocking because it goes against the common wisdom. During the dispute, when all this is going on, his son-in-law, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, published an article in the journal Judaism in which he explained, he doesn't say, you know, I'm explaining my father-in-law's position, but he explained the logic behind this. And let me read you what Rav Lichtenstein wrote, and then I'll read you what the Rav says about this, because we have the letter of the Rav explaining his position. Not explaining his position, just saying how foolish the court is and how foolish so many rabbis are. And then we have, which I found, a letter from someone else who heard from the Rav. And as far as I know, it's the only time we have it from the Rav's mouth explaining his position on this matter, halacha l'maisa, and it comes from his father. So I'll share that with you as well. But first, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, this is what Rav Aaron says. As long as you identify with the Jewish people, not merely with the political state, but with the Knesset Yisrael, even the gravest of sinners remains a Jew. You could do all the sins in the book, but as long as you have identification with Knesset Yisrael, and I think Rav Aaron would say also, even if you don't know any better, because the distinction is going to be one who gives it up versus one who's a sinner but still knows where he comes from. Because the Rav isn't speaking about these people in the Soviet Union who don't even know they're Jewish. And just, you know, that's not what we're referring to. He says, as a member of a spiritual community, this person retains his quintessential character, which is both the spiritual quality and a legal status, Kedushas Yisrael. However, Rav Aaron says, with the loss of identification is the loss of identity. He says, personal status of a Jew, for marriage or any other purpose, is lost. Rav Aaron says that the distinctive mark of Jewry, that of being a Jew, is effaced. Kedushas Yisrael is destroyed. It may be, and in Kedushas Yisrael, he says, may be a native endowment, but it's not an irrevocable patrimony. It is received, but it must also be taken, and it can be thrown away. So there are certain people who are born Jewish, but you know what? They're no longer Jewish in the sense that you can lend money to them on interest. You don't have to save them. And all these things, for all practical purposes, they do not have any Jewish standing. They are not to be regarded as Jewish. And they wouldn't inherit all these things. They're out. How do they get back in? Do they have to go to the mikvah? Others, some say they would. So this is from Rav Aaron. Then you can read Rav Aaron's essay. He sets it out. But here we have a letter, number 9, to Goldschlag, in which he says as follows. Because he says that to Goldschlag, you don't know how important this question, this issue of Brother Daniel is for many Jews in America who are weak, who are not very strong connected to the tradition, and they're not tied to Judaism. There are many Jews, he says, throughout America that are not they refuse to be part of the church. They're not going to apostate. They're irreligious, but they would never apostatize. Why? Because they see this as begida bu'uma. You know, they're not going to be religious. They don't care about Torah, but they're not going to, they're still a Jew, and they're not going to be a traitor to their people. He says, if Chas v'Sholom, the High Court of Israel, had come out with a decision in favor of the Meshuman, that he's able to enter the land of Israel as a citizen based on the law of return, the Rav says that this would, this last connection, it would just completely break. And who knows what it would, because then you'd have all of a sudden, now that Jews who have no connection really to Torah or anything, they would see that the state of Israel says that you can be Christian and still be recognized as a Jew. That is, you can believe in Jesus and still be recognized as a Jew. So all these people who intermarried, who didn't care, that now they're being told by the state of Israel, which in their mind is the highest authority for the Jewish people, that yes, you can be, you can convert and still be regarded as Jewish, because Judaism is ethnic. Judaism is biological. If you want to be part of the Christian community, we will still recognize you. So the Rav says this would be disastrous. He says that I have received hundreds of questions, Beli Guzma, without exaggerating, of people who ask me about this. He says that I'm happy to see that even the secular newspapers were happy about this decision of the court. But the ruling of the judges, the words of the judges, that Jewish law recognizes him as a Jew. And if we decided based on Jewish law, then Brother Daniel would have emerged victorious. That has confused everyone here in America. He says, rabbis of Israel, they can gather up sources, just like Shofet Silberg, Justice Silberg did, who's known as a, gather sources that every you know, person who knows a little Talmud knows about, to show that if you're born Jewish, you're always Jewish. Like I said, everyone knows that. Your Kedusha always remains, the Pintel Yid, all that stuff. However, the Rav rejects this. He says that if you look truly at our sources, we see that Mumarut, if apostasy, Mafkia Baharbe Muvanim Kedusha Sisrol, in many ways, apostasy removes you from Kedusha Sisrol. And he says these rabbis don't understand the great responsibility they have, because you had rabbis saying the same thing when they say that this mumar is the Yisrael Gomor Ho. He says, 3 weeks ago, I spoke at Machon HaTechnologi Shel Massachusetts Lifnei Studentim and Professorim. He said, I spoke at MIT before students and professors. And he tells the whole story. Other than this letter, I know of no record of the Rav ever speaking at MIT. So I think that's great. I know he spoke at Rutgers. In fact, on my trip to Greece a few years ago, we had someone, a rabbi, a musmach of YU, who was at the talk. The Rav spoke at Rutgers. But here he's speaking, he's telling you he spoke in MIT in 63, and he, or 62, because this is Tavis, 60, Tosh and Chaf Gimel. And he tells the story there. And he says, it's a joke here. Tragicomedy, a tragic comedy, that in the state of Israel, Achiloniyot Higin Aladat, that the halachic decision, the proper halachic decision, that an apostate is not to be regarded as a Jew, was arrived at Dafka by the secular court, whereas so many in the Rodas community would have come up with a different decision. And he says, I'm not surprised at all that the position of the rabbis has declined so much in Eretz Yisrael. He says, forgive me, that I'm speaking so harshly here. But the Rav was outraged more than by Silberg, but that you had rabbis who were saying the same thing, that according to halacha, Brother Daniel is a halachic Jew, and he should be recognized by the law of return. Or if the law of return was a halachic law, he would be recognized. And the Rav says, absolutely not. Okay, so where does the Rav get this? Or is it that we just are making false assumptions? there has to be a, just I mean, from Svara, there has to be a distinction between an irreligious Jew, even one who's a hater of Torah and a complete rejecter of it, and an apostate. I mean, that's obviously a basic thing. Rav Tzadok speaks about it. Many others speak. Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg. Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg, in his dispute with the Rogatchover, he had this case where this is actually, it was the Rogatchover's, talk about Nogei Abedavar, it was the Rogatchover's daughter. She was married to Rabbi Citron. He was the Rav of Petach Tikva, a big Zionist, by the way, a religious Zionist, who unfortunately dies young. I don't even know if he was maybe 50, 51, very close to Rav Kook. It's ironic because the Rogatchover was a big anti-Zionist. But when Rabbi Citron died, so his, the Rogatchover's daughter now didn't have any children, so she needed a chalitza. So there was, there were two brothers. This just shows you how, you know, happens to rabbinic culture, that from religious families, what could happen. He had one brother who was in the Soviet Union, totally irreligious. And then he had another brother that was in Germany, in Königsberg, but had, was an apostate, a Mishumlin, had converted to Christianity. And in Germany, the Beis Din ruled, because they were trying to get the it came through them because they had access or were able to reach out to Russia through the German, through the Russian embassy. They were trying to get the guy in Russia. And the Rogatchover said, forget the brother in Russia. The brother in Russia's, he's a Russia, in Russia. He's a complete nothing. So he's no different than the brother in Königsberg. The brother in Königsberg is also a complete nothing. They're both completely irreligious. Get the chalitza from the brother in Königsberg. And Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg said, absolutely not, that you can't compare. It's hard. We have to work in Russia. It's not so simple. And that's why it was such a hard case. She'd be in Aguna. But Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg said that we can't compare the brother in Russia, who, yes, he's completely irreligious, but he's not a mishumad. And Rabbi Weinberg said that if we adopt the Rogatchover's position, then basically you're turning all irreligious Jews the same status as Mishumud. And from the Rogatchover's perspective, they're both Mechalei Shabbos, they're both Ochei Nevelos and Trefos, they're both the same. And Rabbi Weinberg says, absolutely not, that a Mishumud is a Mishumud. He rejects his people. And that's and there's the Gaonim who say that a Mishumud's completely out of the fold, just like the Rav says. So and you can't use them for chalitza. So what is the Rav's letter? He says it's not a letter now. It's a letter which I found I found it. It's by Shabtai Don Yachya. He signed his name Shabtai Daniel. He was the editor of Hatzofer for many years. A religious guy, of course, a smart guy, not a rabbi, not a big intellectual, but a reporter and a newspaper editor, and wrote many interesting articles in his time. And he reports as follows. I think it's amazing because this is a report that from Rabbi Dr. Ben Meir, Skan Yosef Rosh HaKnesset, now in America. I should have looked up before class who this is. I forget now. From someone, maybe David, will tell us. The must have been in the Mizrahi party here. Skan Yosef Rosh Knesset, and a conversation that he had with Soloveitchik that he reported to Shabtai Dan Yachya. And this explains the Rav's position, how the Rav says that we cannot accept Brother Daniel. I'm curious, if you ask your local rabbi, just ask him out of the blue, you know, well, this person, say, I know that there's a Meshumad here. Would the Meshumad be regarded as Jewish? I think most, even rabbis, would say, yes, he's born Jewish, he's Jewish. It's not a new question. In medieval times, they dealt with this, and you had people converted to Christianity. And Kanefogel, in his recent book, his whole book on this topic, and some thought they had to do go to the mikvah, and there's a whole when they return. So yeah, Kanefogel has a whole book on the status of these apostates. But this is what the Rav said. The Rav pointed to a very interesting Gemara in Yevamos. The Gemara says it may be strange, and this is Yevamos 16b. Rav Yehuda says, in the name of Ravasi, if a non-Jew, a goy, betrothed a Jewish woman, we're concerned that the betrothal might be valid. Why? Because he might be from the 10 tribes. And then they'd ask questions, but that's what they say, that betroth a woman, they're choshesh, that it's a valid betrothal, because the person could be descended from the mother, and he could be descended from the 10 tribes. Well, if that's the case, ein lo davar sof, then no one's a guy. You can't even take interest from anyone, because everyone, we're assuming that they could be Jewish. So obviously, you can't have that as an answer, but how are you going to get rid of it? Well, the Gemara on the very next daf, this is what the Rav calls attention to. What do they say? It says that the Chazal did not move from there, the place where they delivered this matter, until they rendered all of them, including those who intermarried with the 10 tribes, different locations, full-fledged Gentiles. So in other words, Chazal, or the sages, established that all these people who are descended from the 10 tribes are regarded as non-Jews. Why? And therefore there's no concern about the betrothal, because they quote a pasuk, the pasuk in Hosea, Bahashem bagadu kivanim zari yoladu. They have dealt treacherously against the Lord. They have begotten strange children. What the Rav says from his father is that we see from here that there's a distinction. Bahashem bagadu, those who reject Hashem, those who give up our religion, our people, and adopt another, you become assimilated, you intermarry with them, and you adopt, you become one of them. Maybe you become a Hellenizer, start adopting, you know, it's apostasy. There's a difference between irreligious and being part of the people, and then those who completely abandon our people. Hashem Bagadu, and it says they had non-Jewish children. That is, they've abandoned us completely. And so he says that his father, Rav Moshe, says, that's what's important. Do they still feel a connection to the Jewish people? They could not be religious at all, but if they still have a connection, they're a part of us. However, if they've given us up, if they're worshiping another religion, if they're intermarrying. Now, today, people intermarry, they still feel part of Judaism. They don't know. They're Tinok Shenishba. But in the days of Hosea, if you intermarried, that means you're out. And I dare say that 100 years ago, if you intermarried, then that was it. You're giving it up. And that's what Ramosha says. Yitaken chi Yehudi yachol liyot mumar achol haTorah kula. You can be a mumar for the entire Torah. Vafil avodas kochavim, he says. And you could even worship idols. Aval einu ad kedei kach menata hishtachlot olam Yisrael. But you haven't broken off your connection with Israel. What do I mean? Look in the books of Kings and the book of Samuel. You have all these Jews, they worship idols, but that's a sin like other sins. That's a sin like violating Shabbos. But they're still part of the Jewish people, but they had a Yetzer Hara to worship idols. That's not what we're referring to. We're referring to people who give up the God of Israel and move into this world and now worship the idols. Those who are worshiping idols together with the God of Israel, we're not referring to that. Those are great sinners, but they're still Jews. But those who give it up entirely, those who become a Catholic friar, and they give up completely Judaism, they are no longer a part of the Jewish people, as Rav Moshe Soloveitchik says, and that's the Rav's position. And then he said the Rav brought another raya, another proof, and this is not from his father. The first proof is from Rav Moshe. The second is the Rav's own proof, that the Rambam says in the Parasha Mishnah, in Masachas Nida, the end of chapter 7, he says that it also deals with the Kuti, who were thought, at least at the time, to be quasi-Jewish. But the Gemara, we know that in times of the Gemara, he says that they established them completely not Jewish. And he elaborates on this. And it, again, what's the upshot of this? That a mumar gomor, la'avdil mikofer, a mumar she'ozev et Am Yisrael, al yedei kabbalah al atzmo dat acheret, someone who goes to the extent of abandoning Judaism, adopting another religion, he is in the status of Hashem, Bahashem Bagadu, and Dino Kedin Oved Kochavim Gomor Afilu Lokula. In all respects, he's regarded. So this brother Daniel is regarded as a non-Jew, not just lachumra, lakua, completely. You can lend money to him, and any time you have a distinction between a Jew and a non-Jew. How you relate to the non-Jew, you relate to brother Daniel that way, lakua or lachumra. Is this a chiddush of the Rav? Is this an opinion, a das yachid? I have to say, I don't know. If you'd ask all the other poskim, what do they hold? Was brother Daniel halachically Jewish? I'm not sure what they would say. It could be that the Rav's a minority. I'm not sure. But the Rav felt very strongly about this. So strongly, he felt that the other rabbis who were saying that halachically brother Daniel is Jewish, he thought they were megalopanim shalok halacha. He thought that they were distorting halacha, quite apart from the fact that he thought this was going to have a terrible implication in America. People hear that you can be an apostate. You could be a Christian priest and you could be Jewish at the same time. You could be a Jew for Jesus, for heaven's sakes. So that he thought that would have a terrible impact. But apart from that, he thought that from a pure halachic standpoint, this was absolutely incorrect, and this speaks very strongly here in this. So we ought to be thankful for Shapta Dan Yochia, who reports here. Now we know it's not just the Rav. He's getting this from his father, and the Rav adds his own position. And we have a lot of listeners, many, many more, who are not listening live. And some of you are pretty expert, I see, in the writings of the Rav. Let me know. Does the Rav ever say this in Revar and Lichlasim? So he explains and he goes into it, but he doesn't quote the Rambam here, and he doesn't mention, as far as I recall, I don't remember if he mentions Hosea. I'll look and see if he mentions Hosea. But the second proof from the Parish of Mishnah, I don't know if we have any other text where we see this from the Rav. So we have to give credit here to the journalist who reports on this. So very interesting. Oh, I see it's all the time. I'll make a note for myself. If Ravaron, I don't recall him mentioning that verse from Hosea, but I'll check just to be sure. So let me get to the comments here and the questions. Now, I think there's an aspect here of Christianity. Christianity is the great enemy, the great persecutor. We all know that if someone's Jewish and also does Buddhism, they call him a Jubu, people don't have the same reaction. They think it's strange. They think it's, but it's to see when a Jew converts to Christianity, that's regarded as really treason, treachery, and it's really because of our history with them. You don't get the same reaction if someone, like I said, it's a Buddhist or a Confucian, but maybe you should, because it's also a problem, the same problem. Mark says that he considers Rabbi Jeremy Weider one of my two rebbeim on these in Yonim. Well, unfortunately, or maybe I shouldn't say that, because he can do what he wants, but Rabbi Weider, I wanted to play it for you. They took down his from YU Torah. It seems you don't have his stuff anymore on YU Torah. He has his own website. So for the laning of the Parshios, you can hear it. But for Begilas Esther, you have to do it on the app. And you have to pay to be part of the app. But you take my word for it. Rabbi Weider says...
I have a CD. Same.
A CD. So he says Ritzafat. And I'm assuming he doesn't read the Ktiv. He only reads the Kri. David says on the addition of the letter Kuf in the word Italki and the letter Kuf in the word we read, see the article from the Hebrew Academy of Language that discusses the Marikidushin, and the Tosfos notes that the Kuf is added pursuant to the rules of Greek or Roman, and the Kuf is added in Ezra due to the rules of Persian. Okay, I want you to send that to me, David. I knew nothing about that, and it's good to know. Tosfos there, Rabbeinu Tam calls it Italia Shel Yavan, Italy of Greece. What he's referring to is down by Calabria, down the coast of Sicily. That was, they spoke Greek there. And that was, I think even, it was ruled by Greece until I think the 12th century, or Greek, I don't know if ruled by Greece, by Greek speakers. So I will look at that. Thank you very much. Someone says, I'm surprised in discussing the Rav, you did not mention the tear of his daughter, Tara Tursky, this past week. Well, I didn't mention it because I didn't even know it. So Baruch Dynamis, I did not know that. I thank you for telling me. I had no idea about that. I was in the Tversky house a number of times. I was married, so unlike my friend David Zinberg from Teaneck, I think he went to once Passover Seder to the Tverskys. But I mean, I went to the show a few times, but I was Professor Tversky's assistant in the summer, one summer. So I would go to his house and bring things. And of course, once or twice she came in while we were there. I was with her on a number of occasions at the memorial events. She said something interesting at the memorial event for Professor Tversky. That was the first time she met many of the students. And she said that, you know, she heard over the years all about them, but now she can put the faces to what she heard. So I did not know that. And thank you for that. David says, it's one thing for these pious female skiers to stop for mincha, with a minyan is indeed quite impressive. Yeah, you know what? Those are probably more religious Zionist types, I think, because in the Haredi world, unless German Orthodox, actually, maybe they're Swiss. German Orthodox might have a different approach, because this is one of the big distinctions in the modern Orthodox, in the religious Zionist world. It's a thing, at least among many, that girls daven, even mincha. And in the Haredi world, they're not mocked on that as much. Here's a quote from Jewish Adventist. Gam Gam is under Lubavitch kosher supervision, always Pas Yisrael, Pish Yisrael, Chav Yisrael, or Glatt kosher. Yes, Gam Gam is the super kosher restaurant in Venice. But functionally, even when it had Ashkacha from Rabbi, I'm looking even someone right now who was with me on the trip to Italy. But even when it had Ashkacha, it wasn't a real Ashkacha. The rabbi is far, far away. The Mashkiach, the one who ran it, was the local Chabad rabbi, and he owned it. And the reason I stress this is because I think all these people making these blanket statements that you can't trust a place unless there's an outside mashkiach, even though the Shulchan Aruch is explicit that you can, and even though all the poskim are, because of this takon of the Vat Abar Tzos, I don't think they're actually seeing this through. What this means is that therefore you can't eat in any Chabads. And that's what he said, by the way, in the interview, if you listen to Vilzig. But I don't think there are actually most people, your local rabbi who would say this, is not really seeing it through, that this is a takana. It's not halacha. It's a takana, maybe a very good takana, because obviously that's a conclusion we can't arrive at. It's a conclusion that the takanas don't work everywhere. In a few weeks, I'm going to violate this takana because I'm having an event and the local Chabad Rebbetzin, she's making food for me and the other person. And I'm paying her, and it's a little side business, and that's how Jews have always done it, and we're not going to stop doing it. So that's just, and they're still going to keep eating in Gam Gam. Oh, David tells us that it's still punishable under the Israeli Penal Code to engage in missionizing, and that's missionizing, I guess, for any religion, not just for, Christianity. Friars look like the mascot for the Padres. They are called Franciscans, are connected to the 26 California missions. And Franciscans are not necessarily priests. They have the little rope around them. They could be priests, but they're not priests necessarily. And but I'm not sure if you have to be a Franciscan to be a friar. We say Franciscan friars, but I think, I'm not sure, you can check. I should know, I'm at a Catholic university, but I'm not sure whether every friend's friar is also Franciscan. David says that Professor Yitzhak Englard, who's written a number of good articles on Jewish law, who was also on the Supreme Court, criticized the majority decision of the court that said that it's a secular rule and asserted that the judges should have adopted a halachic definition, which is despite the fact that that Brother Daniel remained Jewish, he nonetheless lost his rights as a Jew. He remained chayav to keep the mitzvos. So he should not have been entitled to citizenship under the law of return. It's an interesting point because even according to the Rav, does that mean that there's still a chiyuv on the apostate to fast on Yom Kippur? I mean, if he doesn't, he can't stop having a chiyuv. But we have no connection to him. So the Rav is, in his language, he says in the exact language of the Rav, I think, is he says in many aspects he loses mafkia b'harbei muvanim kedushas Yisrael. So he acknowledges that there's certain elements that there's a so for instance, an apostate woman, if she has a child, the child is Jewish because the child hasn't given up. We're not Chazal. We can't say Chazal could get together and say that all these people, they're no longer Jewish and their descendants. But I think it's fair for me to say that everyone would acknowledge, including the Rav, that an apostate woman who has a child, the child is halachically Jewish. I think. I don't know, maybe not, but I think so. Question. The coalition wants to deny right of return to converts when the halacha says converts are Jews and should not have their previous status spoken about. What's the halacha based on that opinion? Right now, the law of return permits any converts. The only converts who have a problem under the law of return are Orthodox converts. An Orthodox convert who has a conversion by an Orthodox rabbi who the Rabbanut does not accept, it's a problem. But if you have a conversion with a conservative rabbi or a former rabbi, you have no problem according to the laws of the state of Israel. Eli says the Rav spoke in February or January of 62 on a Friday night to Yavna Shabbaton in Brookline and quoted students from MIT. I'm talking about not speaking to a Yavna Shabbaton. Well, maybe that's it. You know, you're right. That could be it. But I don't know because he's writing in this letter. This is in January of 63. He says 3 weeks ago, I spoke at MIT. So that would be in December of 62, not in January. Someone asked, what about the children of apostate who discover the Jewish roots? That's the case I just mentioned. As far as I know, they are regarded as 100% Jewish. And because they have not given it up. They're Tinok Shenishva. If anyone knows differently, tell me. I've had cases like this in Scranton, actually. Now, Michael says, what about Unitarians? A Unitarian doesn't... Well, listen, you could be a Meshumad. It doesn't mean you have to be an Oved Avodah Zarah. If you reject Judaism and you become a Muslim, you're not worshiping Avodah Zarah, but you're still a Meshumad. So you become a Unitarian, you're a Meshumad. The Avodah Zarah is not the crucial element here. It's you can adopt another religion. You know, the Rambam's position is the standard one. It's the one we accept, but it's not the majority opinion, I don't think. The Rambam holds, give it a choice, convert to Islam or die. The Rambam says you convert because it's not Avodah Zarah. But the Ritva, the Radbaz, and many others reject the Rambam because they assume that the real crime, I've said this before, Avodah Zarah, it's not just a technical thing that if you have a, instead of Avodah Zarah, bowing down to this idol, or you have to give up your life. Avodah Zarah is really the outward manifestation. The Ritva is clear on this, that and others. And Chaim Soloveitchik thinks this is really the correct opinion, that the Rambam was sort of bending over backwards to try to get out of it. The real capital offense is denial of the Torah, rejecting the Torah. You convert to Unitarianism, you convert to Islam, you're rejecting the Torah. And that's a capital offense, quite apart from Avodah Zarah. Yes, thank you, Rivka, for mentioning this. I did not know. I was told by Professor Tursky that Atara, who I gather is the oldest, when she was born, and she was born in Berlin, that Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg was the first one at the hospital. And I did not know this. Thank you for telling me all this. Okay, this past Shabbos, the Shilas from the Aguda of Illinois answered the same Kashrus questions. Nissan called my attention, why you's having a big event in a few weeks, and one of the Rosh Yeshiva is speaking on this. I can't tell you why this has become a big deal now. And like I said, I don't want people to misunderstand me. I think you should have these takanot. I don't think you can have a situation where everyone in town is, especially in the more modern Orthodox, are preparing food because you don't know who's who. But at the end of the day, if you're in Mea Shearim, And they've been doing this for who knows how long. When they, you know, Thursday night, someone starts selling this thing, and to say that they need to have a hashgacha, and to say that now the Chabad rabbi in Benares, India, he's the only religious Jew in the whole city, that he can't sell me food when I go there because he needs to have a mashgiach. That's not the tradition. I read you what the Eretz Chaim said. That's not Me'ikar Adin. A takana is a takana. It's going beyond. It's going extra. The whole thing, we have mashgiach tamidi. Why do you have mashgiach tamidi? There's no halacha you need a mashgiach tamidi. It's good to have mashgiach tamidi. We're going beyond. It's an extra. You're going to say a restaurant without mashgiach tamidi is not a good restaurant? You don't have that in Shulchan Aruch. You don't have that in Shulchan Aruch. If it's a muchzor b'kashrus, it's fine. So in some places in the world, that's the way it is. And it's for us to then tell the Jews in these other places that you're not doing right, especially for the travelers. We already know the Noda Yehuda says that we do leniencies for travelers. So even if you hold this is what should be done. So I don't know. Something's going on here. If they're trying to shut down the people in Mea Shearim and elsewhere who are selling these things. And when Rabbi Chaim Kanievsky says it's not an issue. And
Rav Dr. Marek, the Beis Hillel that you sent us to last week, and thank you for sending me the exact citation, as I emailed you, it seems that even that Takana B'Pinkas, and thank you for teaching me that that means Takana B'Devad Arbar Rasot, it seems that... even he, when he mentions it, he says, yeah, they did that for a low plug, but if you know someone who has a cheskat kashrut, he maintains it. You know, and so I didn't see clearly where he says it wasn't accepted. It seems that he himself didn't accept it. So this idea that you stated so clearly from the Eretz Hamda that Eidechadar and Visurin, even when there is Negius, that's what it says in the Beis Hillel. And if you read the Pesachei Shuvah and the Remains, they all seem to have this idea. Yes,
you know, I have to tell you this, you sent that to me. I didn't get a chance to read it. So I wasn't sure. Now I'm going to have to go to read it, that the Beis Hillel quotes at the Kana, and you're saying that he continues later. It says it doesn't apply to a Muslim Bekashras. I have to look at that.
It's a good idea. He says yes, yeah. and it was meant for low plug. He says that, but there are situations where you don't have to abide by it. Exactly what the Eretz Chemda said. The Eretz Chemda summarizes the Beis Hillel, my understanding of the Beis Hillel.
Well, I said the Beis Hillel means that the Hechsher we're talking about, it's not going in the house and looking in your cabinets. It's a declaration that this person is a muhsak b'kashrus. That's what he's saying. And you need that because of low plug, because this person, you can't say, well, this person we know that you don't know. So that's the exact case of a Chabad.
The Shulchan Aruch speaks of, in case of Shulchan Aruch, is about Nikor HaGir, about, you know, how to devein the Gir HaNosha. That's their kashrus issue. So if you have someone who's a muhsak and knows how to do it, the question is, do you then have to take that meat and show it to someone else who's also? So they discuss all these things, and the consensus is that you don't. You rely on the person. And even though he has nagias, it says that explicitly. Summarizes everything.
Yes. And that's why, again, I'm not a halakhic authority, but I'm a historian, and I can show you exactly how it was done. So it's like, if we're going to recreate the wheel and make believe now that, you know, these things never happen, I'm telling you that you can't say that this was always accepted. It wasn't always. So if you want to make a takana now, it could be a very good takana. But the idea that this is Me'ikar Adin, or that this is always accepted everywhere, it was not accepted. And I worked at the Hosher Hotel where all the Gedolim came to, and they didn't have Mashgiach there. What can I tell you? Mike says there's several tshuvas from Rishonim where they talk about people converted out of Judaism, and none of them consider the person non-Jewish. The Shulchan Aruch discusses in Yoredeya. You're saying the Rav is against all the Gedolim, all the generations on this issue. Well, the Gaonim speak about, they don't think that someone who is apostate can do chalitza, as I recall. So if I'm not mistaken, it's the machokas, the Gaonim, and the Rishonim. So, but again, Kanefa will have all the sources. The Rambam David says, I quoted in commentary, the Mishnah rules that the corpse of a kuti is not matami. So I do not know if one can conclude if the child of Meshumet is deemed to be Jewish or not. Yeah, I don't know. And then it says, this paper, you say, brings a chuvah for Rosh Mosh. It says explicitly, not like the Rav, about the children of converts. He's speaking about in Spain, the people who converted in Spain. The assumption of the people who converted in Spain, they said that they still wanted to be Jewish. That's why secretly they're being Jewish. That could be different. That's different than the case that someone who just, let's say, converts to Catholicism and leaves us behind. But it could be that the Rav's position is not the mainstream position. I don't know. Michael says on the question whether the child of the Meshulmet is Jewish, doesn't the Gemara in Yevamos negate that? It's a good point because they needed the rabbis to come and make that declaration. But I think the Rav would say that once the rabbis established this principle, that then applies continuously. If we see that someone is an apostate, b'Hashem b'gadu, that applies everywhere. I think that's what the Rav quotes his father as citing that. The Rav quotes his father as citing that Gemara. So it's Dafka they learned from that Gemara that apostates have removed themselves. Okay, now Rabbi Kelman is not here to announce. I don't want to do any more about this kashrus thing, although it's interesting. So I'll reply privately, but I know people found it of interest because we are seeing before our eyes right now a very fascinating thing. We find the rabbis, not entirely, but a lot of the rabbis pushing back against something, fighting back against something. And I think in the end, we'll end up somewhere in the middle ground. But does this mean that at the Mir Yeshiva, a guy can't, his wife makes a little cake, he can't come sell it to make a little extra money? We already have the great post-king saying that that's allowed. So I don't know where this is going to end up at the end of the day, what's going to happen. So remains to be seen in this. And I'm going to go back to the Beis Hillel because I printed it out, but I never actually looked at it. And I never really responded properly because I didn't have time. So I will do that later, but I can respond privately to you. So thank you all. We will see you in, God willing, in 2 weeks. Have a very nice Purim. And if you're in the New York area, enjoy what hopefully will be our only snowstorm for this season. Good night, everyone.